Welcome to The Solutionists, the therapy session your workplace didn't know it needed.
Stick with us. We have problems to solve.
Welcome back to The Solutionists, a podcast with myself and Chief Solutionist Sharon Pierce, where we get into organizational dirty laundry and tell the truth that people aren't always quite ready to hear. And for today's episode, we're going to getting into the whole thing of transformation, but culture transformation this time around. The thing that people like Sharon are called into organizations to just magically fix, right? Sharon gets called in, an organization says, our culture sucks. Let's transform it with a project as though you can buy a new culture off the shelf. Now, I don't know about any of you, but if you've ever tried to drag a misbehaving partner to a therapist, you will know you can't change people. People don't change. You have to work with what you've got, or you have to replace them with someone new if you really want to transform the culture within your own internal organization, aka your house. And the same really applies when it comes to organizations, doesn't it, Sharon? You can't just buy a new culture off a shelf or throw money at the problem and think it's going to get fixed.
As you're talking, it's very hard for me not to burst out laughing. But culture transformation and operating model transformation are normally two very big transformations that we get called in to deliver. Interestingly, they're seen as separate when in fact they probably are more synonymous than people realize. And yes, you can't buy it off a shelf. It takes hard work that oftentimes people aren't willing to do.
You say people get confused with culture transformation and operating model transformation. What are these two things? And are they distinct, or are they really better seen as one thing? So define how they're currently defined, but also then tell us how they probably should be looked at instead.
I'm going to tell you how Google defines them, so please don't see this as my direct quote, but culture transformation is often seen and or referred to as that intentional process of reshaping an organization's shared values, beliefs, behaviors, to align to a new strategic direction or changing direction or market conditions. And it's quite a big, large-scale change. And the aim is to change what is embedded in people's mindsets and behaviors and how they feel and how they think and how they act, essentially.
So reprogramming people, you're trying to reprogram the way people think, act, and feel.
Greenify, okay. Yellowify, redify, whatever color your organization's logo is.
Rainbowify.
The something way or the big culture shift, etc. An operating model transformation is a little bit different in that it's the sort of reconfiguration of your people, your process, and your practices, often involving large-scale sort of structural change to a new way of working and really servicing customers, clients, etc. That's really what the starting point should be. Often it isn't. And it encompasses people as well. So it's a people process, practice, technology, full review and revamp of roles and responsibilities. And like you said, they are often run very separately and with every new leadership change. It's like, almost like a dog marking their territory, right? There's some sort of big structural change or cultural change. The cultural stuff is kind of a new brand or, you know, a vision or something sexy added to our strategy for the next 5 years is, arrow, you know, pointing in the right direction or whatever. These things are often given names and they start off as 1.0 and then 2.0 and then 3.0 and then 4.0. And these EVP documents that you see scattered over the internet about how amazing we are and come and work here because we just value our talent so much.
Mm, new posters for the walls,
yeah,
right?
Actually,
new words, like we are this now, we're not this, we that.
And in preparation for this podcast, I even sort of went as far as to going into ChatGPT and going, well, you know, the biggest employers in South Africa, you know, the top 100 employers or the best companies to work for, you know, share their vision statements. They all have the same words, you know, like we are talent magnets or, you know, our beliefs and values are to do good with whatever expertise we have. We're inclusive. We value difference. You know, we expect everyone to be themselves and to show up as individuals at work, etc. And what's interesting is that culture hits you in the face in many ways that are contrary to what's on these posters.
We must actually put in the show notes the link to that infamous video clip that went around during COVID, where all organizations all came out with their "we're going to survive through this period" sort of organizational culture pieces, and somebody very cynically strung them all together and showed how every corporation was saying exactly the same thing.
We are really at the end of it, and I think I sometimes wish our podcasts were live, Bron, because I mean I'm going to share a couple of examples with you shortly, as you know, and if we were able to ask the audience to comment on like a Facebook Live in this particular instance around how culture really hits you in the face, then I think we'd get the views of the masses who are, all rolled up, riled up and excited when there's like a big town hall and flashing lights and amazing music and a true sense of togetherness. And we riled up for the moment, but then it slaps you in the face in the passage. And I'll explain some of those examples a bit later.
So in your perspective, when it comes to, let's start with the culture piece, mm-hmm. and then we can kind of string it together with the operating model transformation. But when it comes to culture, where does culture come from? Is culture something that can be bought off the shelf, that can be dictated to you, that can be managed at all? Or is culture a function rather of the ecology of the organization? Does it come from the edges, or does it come from the center, or is it a bit of both?
I think it's a bit of both. And I think this is where we often mistake operating model and culture work as being separated. For me, it lies in the practices. And maybe I should hit the team at this point to illustrate my point around how it slaps you in the face. So I'm going to ask the audience to just bear with me, because I think at some point one or more of these examples will be relevant to you. But I'm going to give it a go if that's okay with you, Bron. Mm. The first is the busyness bullshittery. So no one else works around here. I'm the first one in the morning. I basically close the curtains at night. I have to rewrite everything everyone in my team does. They can't communicate in English, and I don't have time to do my job and everyone else's. So you've just come from this auditorium, flashing lights, big disco, rah, rah event of, our culture shift says X, Y, and Z, and these new posters and great new branding. Mm. And this manager hits you in the face with a comment like that. Or the PowerPoint wasteland, you're being summoned after an exco. There was a big board meeting and somebody's interpreted a directive from the CEO that we need to turn around an analysis to prove once again that diversity, equity, inclusion is really an important thing for our organization and what other organizations similar to ours are doing. And it must be done by tomorrow. Your boss doesn't even download it because the adrenaline post exco subsided. Or when they do call you to present at the next meeting, no one remembers why we even asked for this in the first place. The next is the performance process poop. Mm-hmm. The curve made me do it. When your manager sits down with you after the performance cycle and says, and you've already had your discussion, so you're really expecting a confirmation of an exceeding rating on your performance review. And they say, well, we had a calibration session, and after all things were said and done, the team didn't agree. I mean, I tried to fight with you so hard, but I was forced to rank you one, rating lower. Or the diversity delusion and the African unicorn myth, when the DEI committee gets called in for an exception appointment of a misaligned resource to target because we just can't find any Africans in this haystack of 60 million people in South Africa. They just do not exist. Another, the efficiency theater, do more with less or stretch yourself. This is a development opportunity. So-and-so has resigned, do their job too, or we'd like to increase your scope, or the many around you with double-barreled job titles, we never stop doing anything, we only just add. The strategic underachievement one, another great one for me, which really lies in SLAs and target settings, which applies to budgets as well. So you rally to spend your budget at the end of the year because you know if you don't, then your budget for next year is going to be what you didn't spend or did spend. And so who cares about value? We'll spend it, and spending is the new target. Sales targets and buckets that we need to fill, we need to stick to relentlessly, because if we outperform those targets, our baseline next year will just go up, you know. Our NPS scores, which is supposed to be a net promoter score, I prefer to call it a net pretend score, or a net or nominal performance score. We close the score when we answered your question and not solved your problem. So you say, oh, great, service was amazing, but no one's tracking that you had to phone another 10 people to get your solution solved. And if the SLA says 4 days, we do it in 4 days, even if we're quite capable of doing it in two. Another one, the leadership performance mystery. My team are such bad performers. I do it all. Their ratings are low. Mine stays great. Everyone else gets a crap performance rating. I did all the work. And no one ever says, but did you hire wrong? Did you lead well? Did you direct correctly? You know, somehow it always falls on the people underneath you. The transparent as a brick wall talent process, coupled with the policy, applies to everyone except leadership, or the mystical exceptional circumstance policy loophole, where we can appoint without a formal process because the talent plan said so. You know, there are hundreds, Bron, changing the role or changing the grade, not the reality. So we call people managers. Mm-hmm. It's faked as career growth because they were really stressed that they don't have an opportunity to manage people. So we give them one person to manage. We, in essence, create complete inefficiency with one-to-one reporting lines. All they really are doing is approving the guy's leave. They still don't have budget accountability, any responsibility, or any decision-making, right? So, hello. The whistleblowing line, that's my favorite, which is used as a grievance hotline instead of an actual whistleblowing hotline, because we don't have difficult direct conversations and hold people accountable for performance, inevitably setting them up for failure in their career development here and outside of our organization, with bad culture seeming to win because everyone believes what goes into a whistleblowing line. Decision-making by committee, Bron, where federated, so everyone must agree. We manufacture these long, amazing governance processes, which are minuted, to get things passed, but it's passed as a paper, not truly embedded as outcome anyway. And so at the time of having to deliver on set goals, there's amnesia on what and who said what, taking extra long to get anything done, with massive sunk cost or opportunity cost lost in the process. Well, how about the last one? Decision-free meeting disease. We get approval on content, not context and outcome. So meeting conversations are literally updates with no real impact on anyone's lives, including our customers. You would debate a retirement policy for months. Should we up the retirement age? The reality is people are dying older. People are living longer. People are going to be working longer. Our reality is on the continent, we have the youngest working population. Does it matter whether the retirement policy says 90? If your talent practices actually work and you're moving people, growing people, and getting them to do what they need to do, you will facilitate those things. And so, yeah, culture hits you in the face, bottom line.
Well, it sounds to me, I'm going to grossly abridge everything you've been saying there, that the distinction between culture transformation and operating model transformation, what's getting lost in translation, is culture transformation is what we say and operating model transformation is what we do. And when we say certain things and do other things and they don't line up, well, of course, people are going to be cynical and lazy and opportunistic and Machiavellian when it comes to their approach. It doesn't matter what it says on the posters. If the process undermines the posters, or at least the philosophy behind the posters, to be a little bit kinder, because sometimes people might actually have good intentions of trying to improve things, then you're certainly not going to get anywhere, because every one of the things you've spoken about are purely cynical ways to get around doing what you've said you're going to do and just do what you're going to do anyway. And that's a big problem, quite obviously, but this is supposed to be the Solutionist podcast, Sharon. Do you have any solutions here, or is this just people being people?
Let's also just kind of be real for a moment, right? You're never going to please an organization of 30,000 people. It's impossible to have everybody pleased and everybody happy and everybody excited and everyone doing what they're supposed to do.
You're getting paid. What is that famous meme with Mad Men where the girl comes into her boss's office and complains that she's never thanked? And he says, that's what the money's for.
But the point, your point is valid around what we say versus what we do. And I just want to point out before I go into the solutionist component that it actually hits your customers too. So in all the complaints, whether it's about a bad banking branch experience where you forced me to engage with a screen and not a person, whether there were long waiting queues, whether a product failed, are often around sort of how we structured and how we measure and how we determine what value is on the inside of an organization. And that's why I say, you know, culture is what we say, but if you're not doing culture and operating model transformation at the same time, what you do becomes completely counterintuitive. And so, you know, words on a page, intents in PowerPoint decks, etc., are all great, but real change requires humans to be mature, which we know is not necessarily the case. It is always, as a program or project, if you are being called to do a large restructure or a large operating model change, it's very rarely proactive. It is often very retrospective, i.e. we've become too inefficient or whatever the case may be. So we need to hold leaders accountable in the future for ongoing continuous change and not large scale big five led transformations that involve these massive projects and huge upheaval. And you can do that by embedding practices differently. So if I, you know, were to give you a frank example, we are in a situation now, as you and I know well from our book, that everyone's complaining about AI and job losses. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of jobs being purged all over the place. The reality is that they probably should have been purged anyway.
This is a great excuse to actually clean out the house that you wanted to clean out for the last 20 years, yeah, but you haven't had the moral courage to do because no one else is doing it. Now, because everyone else is finally clearing out the dead wood, you say, yay, I can finally burn mine too.
And now we blame AI for it. But the reality is it's probably not AI at all. It's actually just that we are too expensive, we are too big, and we got ahead of ourselves because we didn't think about how we are value chained in a way. In addition, you know, the unions in our country hold us accountable for upskilling and reskilling at scale, which is actually super damn difficult to do. But because we have reduced jobs down to task level and activity level, we've broken what should be one thing into 50. You carry 50 people instead of one. And so the reality is that culture transformation and operating model transformation have to go hand in hand. If you create a digital organization, then best you understand what's digital, what's human, how it goes together, and then deeply embed those practices. So I'll use performance again, because performance is a big one. We tend to have a performance curve and we say, like, we've got to be a high performance organization. Yet we allow people to complain on whistleblowing lines about behavior, which is probably just people being direct because you are too sensitive to take direct information about how badly, you know, some things are going, might be, you know, one. Or we aren't holding people accountable for outcomes. The outcome should be that we, you know, shifted a market, we, you know, gained more market share, we delivered extra value, not necessarily that we sold things, because you could sell the wrong product to the wrong customer. I never forget when I opened a bank account for my helper years ago, and the lady obviously had a bucket list target of selling some kind of an account. I can't remember. I think it might have been called an Mzansi account, which had a fees attached to it. Now, this is someone who's never really going to transact on a fee basis. I mean, every time the poor lady has to use the ATM, I have to go with, because she actually can't read or write. But yet you had to sell 10 of these things. So you sold 10 of these things, not, you know, so that's the danger in target setting for the sake of target setting in the wrong context. And so what we do is we wait for the performance cycle to end. We look at our bonus pools, and then we kind of use this curve to determine how far our bonus pool can reach, and we make core decisions. But what we haven't done up front, which should be done right at the beginning of the year, is calibrate what the objective was in the first place. So actually, as teams, not individuals, let's look at everybody at executive level and think through, are we measuring them against the same level of complexity? Or is there some connection to the five executives in this team and the outcome that we wish to achieve? And this is the expectation that we all align and agree on. Instead, we align on it retrospectively. And so instead of spending time calibrating the objective at the beginning of the year and what good looks like, we try and do it retrospectively and end up having what else to call it other than a shit show. And so operating models have to be steeped in deep practice. If we agree, meetings should only exist for 30 minutes and there has to be a decision attached to a meeting, that decision must have some sort of benefit resource-wise or whatever the case may be, then we won't have day-long meetings where people are just getting updates. If we agree that governance is important and everybody must agree, can we at least shift our paper writing culture to one of outcomes, which is actually, you know, we want to drive so many new talent pipelines, da da da, and we're going to do it this way. Can we agree that the outcome we're trying to achieve is proactive talent? There are, at any given point in time, we have three people to fill risk management roles at senior levels across the business. And to do that, we are going to engage the following supplier to market map. Can we all agree that that's the objective, regardless of who does the work? Is very different to, you know, let's agree on a preferred supplier list and getting involved in an RFP that takes more than 14 million years to get people agreeing on across composite businesses that happen to be federated. I mean, it's just, where are we spending our energy? And that is what deep change requires. And it requires deep process level work. You can't just change a structure.
No, that also reminds me, of course, of what Charlie Munger, the great investor, used to always say, like, show me the incentive, I'll show you the outcome. And pretty much everything you've been saying there, it all comes down to those, what are the processes that we are managing? What are the metrics that we are managing? And are we measuring and managing the right thing? Are we measuring the process or are we measuring the outcome? And which outcomes are we rewarding? And which processes and behaviors are we rewarding? And not just explicitly. I think people get that wrong too. They think that it's the explicit management on the rubric. We can fix that and we can fix the incentive layer there. But there's the much deeper incentive layers, which talk about the sense of fairness and or grievance people feel when they are put into that system, when they start to see the emergence of who wins and wins in the corporate setting, being who is rewarded, who is recognized, who is promoted, that create those sort of self-reinforcing loops that you see. But it all comes down to what are those incentives? And again, the incentives are not just explicit, they're often implicit. They're what we do as an organization, not just what we say. And from your perspective there, when it comes to sort of changing those incentives, in a way that can, to draw from Albert Hirschman's Exit Voice and Loyalty, which I think is also super relevant to this conversation. If you want a healthy culture, we can super oversimplify it. The Exit Voice Loyalty framework is basically two dimensions. Are people actively engaged or are they passively checking out? And then are they being constructive or destructive? In other words, are they resentful and working against you from the inside, or are they being progressive and working with you? And obviously, we want people to be both active and constructive. We don't want them to be passive, lazy, free riders, lazy gold jobbers. We want them to be active and enthusiastic. And therefore, we need incentives that get people away from apathy and destruction towards contribution and progressive, active contribution to the organization. So ultimately, how do you move those two axes? How do you change the incentive structure to get more people in the voice quadrant, in the active and constructive sector of the organization? When you interrogate it like this, it's very easy. You can go into an organization and check people into those boxes, see who's leaning in, who's leaning out, who's trying, who's not trying, who's undermining and freeloading, and who is working hard and going forward. How do you change those incentives?
The first is how you think and how you wire. And I think how we wire and organize is part of our problem. And it doesn't, you know, I've always said this to you and I've said it to many people. Actually, structure shouldn't matter. If people are being adults, we should be able to get the outcome we are looking for. But the reality is, you know, people aren't necessarily wired that way. So,
or you haven't hired the right ones.
Or you haven't hired the right ones, which is, I mean, again,
that's a part of culture. You can have massive, the most perfect system and incentive structure. Agreed. If you put the wrong players into the game, no one's going to kick the ball.
There's a lot of consequence management below management level, but not a lot for managers sometimes, you know, and I think that's got to change. But let's go back to hardwiring and rewiring. In a large operating model construct, you would value chain, right? So, you know, typical value chain is there's some sort of diagnostic around a customer's need and there's insight. And then that insight translates into a product. That product translates into a value proposition for a client segment or multiple segments, which translates into distribution of said product, which in turn leads to the enablement and support of said product, which, you know, leads to continuous learning and reimagination. And I mean, that's all, you know, sort of what we tend to do is we set up the structure and we go, okay, cool. We're going to have product guys, and then we're going to have segment guys, and then we're going to have distribution guys. And essentially you end up spending half your life fighting a product versus segment led debate. Are we marketing led or sales led, et cetera. And so setting up your organization for success involves being able to be really clear around how those processes work. And often what we do is we stop at the structure part and then we don't sort of embed it into, okay, well, now how do we start to set goals and who are we holding accountable for what and where's the overlap and where is it not? So it's not about who has the power in decision making, but a collective decision around a customer segment. If a customer is being hit with 15 different calls from a business bank, for example, a retail bank, a private bank, an investment arm, a bank assurance arm, or an insurance arm, that's not a customer-centric view. And so when you're product-led, that tends to happen, right? And so we've got to really start to think about how we hardwire organizations. And I'll use the one example, which is super old, but one that has resonated with me throughout my career and happened to have been in the right place at the right time, which is how I got into the work that I do at a very young age. But working for a family-owned business that was now trying to globalize, expanding into Africa very, very rapidly, we simplified those conversations at a strategic level to what does this business need to be super hot at in order to be successful? And it was quite clear. We've got to be great at creating demand. We've got to be awesome at executing on that demand, which is market execution. And we've got to be awesome at demand fulfillment. In other words, production, manufacturing, etc. And then what enables that will be the risk and the finance and all of that other stuff. But we were quite clear on those three things are of sort of equal value and importance. And then through that process defined what the roles would be, the accountabilities would be, how we'd start to measure and manage performance. And in order for us to be a super hot demand fulfillment capability or an excellent demand creation capability, we acknowledge that there would be tensions between those three capabilities, and there always will. And it's important that there is, otherwise you're never going to deliver to the customer. But at the center was customer centricity and culture, and therefore how we make decisions, how we budget, in what format, how long does it take, who resolves issues, when there is sort of a debate around whether something does or doesn't go to market and those three capabilities can't align and agree, where do we make that call? And is it in a four-day exco in which we're trying to look good to board, or is it actually putting the cards on the table and explaining we actually need you to help to broker a decision on something that we would otherwise be incentivized to hide from boards in the context of how organizations operate today? And so that was sort of the first piece, but sitting around that was really fundamentally shifting practices, how we defined roles, how we defined decision making, how we defined sort of communication processes, how you define the budgeting process, you know, to ensure that that thing works seamlessly. And you can't just stop at structure, which we often do. We think, okay, well, we've announced a new structure, we've given people new roles, and now everyone will behave. It does not work like that. The entire fabric of how you are wired together, how your exco teams meet, engage, what they talk about, etc., is really, really important. And you have to hire for it too.
You made a very good point there, especially speaking about that example in terms of that I will simplify again, transparency and honesty in being honest at talking about what we're talking about and understanding that there are trade-offs, that there are constraints, that it's not perfect for everyone, that not everyone is being pleased all the time if they are competing objectives. And that reminded me of the work that we did in the future space during COVID, looking at researching which countries survived, very literally, COVID the best, which were the ones that had the most resilience, the lowest deaths, and the lowest costs in terms of both culture and in terms of economics. And it was very, very clear it came down to one factor, and that was the degree of trust within the society. And trust, of course, requires honesty, but it also requires empowerment. It requires managing on output again or on result rather than managing controls. So countries that tried to impose rules on populations had resistance, had conspiracy theories, had, you know, rebellions, and didn't actually get the results they wanted. Countries that had agreed on a, we would like to survive this, had people that were much more kind, considerate, willing to make personal sacrifices for the greater good without being forced to do it. And this was so interesting to kind of see. And of course, the emblematic country that came out of that was Taiwan, which didn't impose rules, but it had principles that people followed, and everyone followed it voluntarily because they understood that what was good for them was good for the group, even though it meant personal sacrifices. And these things applied directly towards the way any team works. Any team or organization has to have that trust and that transparency and being honest about the problems and the challenges. And of course, that trust comes from transparency and honesty. And these are virtuous cycles, as opposed to the converse, which is cycles of control and surveillance that breed resentment and rebellion and don't actually get people to work together. You've got three different managers with different objectives that sometimes clash. There has to be a format and a comfort where people are prepared to speak about these things and negotiate for the broader picture behind it, which is we'd all like to survive and we'd all like to get promoted. We'd all like, quite frankly, to get very, very rich by the end of this. We can only do that if we work together, and that transparency and communication is that fundamental layer. That's perhaps a clue. Like, are you fostering a culture of trust and communication, or are you fostering a culture of work to rule and management?
Operationalizing that is where we fall flat. Mm. So we talk about psychological safety and we measure it in engagement surveys, and everyone's convinced that it's, you know, psychologically safe. But then you go into a board meeting or an exco in which you share a bad news story and all of a sudden you get cucked out.
It's what and you do again, not what you say.
Exactly. And so the reality is being able to surface through real practices and routines and I don't know what another word would be, but a way for us to embed in the very things that we do, like budget approvals, like, you know, okay, you didn't spend the money, so now you can't get the same amount of money ever again in your whole entire lives. You know, well, maybe the game changed in year two and you do need a little bit more money. Do we, you know, is that not something that becomes a flexible thing? Or yes, we did contract performance objectives up front, but all of a sudden there was a tsunami, you know? So, I mean, is it flexible enough that we, you know, don't expect the same amount of population to walk through the banking doors because actually the building died, you know, whatever the case may be. It's a damn example, but you get my point. So, yeah, I think that is there's something about doing that deep process work, which is incredibly tough to do. And I always marvel at the amazing best company to work for surveys, which essentially is you marking your own homework, submitting some fancy PowerPoint deck about how you are embedding all of this great flexibility in your organization and hybrid work and all this other stuff. But when your manager doesn't see you, you're in shit in the real world because it's hitting you in the face. At the end of the day, it's not what people say, it's what people do.
So come on, Sharon, we did promise our listeners on the show that we'd be airing some corporate dirty laundry. And I know you've got stories to tell. I know you can't name names and shame faces. But come on, tell us a specific story about an absolute culture transformation failure. And of course, change names and faces. All names and faces referred to in this podcast are entirely fabricated. And if they bear any resemblance to reality, that's just your imagination playing tricks on you, as a disclaimer.
I did in every single one of the earlier examples when I talk about the busyness bullshittery, the PowerPoint wasteland, the performance process poop, the diversity delusion.
Way more specifics. Those are wonderful textbooks.
No, they're not textbooks. They actually are happening right now. I mean, I was legitimately kicked out of a meeting.
That's what we want to hear.
Legitimately kicked out of a meeting on a diversity, equity, and inclusion discussion in which I challenged a team of people around an appointment and said, is this really where you want to be spending your energy? And of course, I wasn't invited back. And anyway, said human is now no longer in the building. But the point of the matter is that, you know, highlighting honesty and transparency and real conversations around, you know, the African unicorn myth that, you know, like I said, this haystack of 60 million people, it does exist. You just have to do talent differently. And if people aren't wanting to join you, the very rare unicorns that do exist, why aren't we having the conversation about why not? Why are we having the conversation that they don't exist, now we must hire white people? And I know this isn't, you know, diversity is way bigger a conversation than it is about race and targets and compliance. And you know how I feel about that. We are not thinking through our talent processes around what capabilities do we put in front of our customers, because we want our customers to interface with people that resonate with them for whatever reason, whether it's a knowledge base, whether it's a understanding base, whether it's an empathy base, whatever the case may be. We're not having those conversations. And so that's one example of how culture hits you in the face. You know, being honest and, you know, just not, you know, it's not, I'm not ever going to be somebody's favorite person on a transformation agenda, because unless you're willing to embrace honesty and transparency and deal real issues,
if you're looking for excuses as to why it,
to fake it, many do.
Yeah.
So, you know, often you kind of have to pull yourself out or kill yourself trying. And at the end of the day, consultants always get blamed. So interesting.
I feel like we're going to need another episode on the diversity questions, which are so contentious, but of course critical. And you've alluded to some of those points. I think we should pick up on that going forward. But yes, Sharon. So I think to wrap up with today, let's go back right to the beginning and about this idea of transformation. We figured out that there's the difference between what we do and what we say. But there's also the other issue of buying it, as we said, off the shelf. This idea that you can reduce transformation to a project. We've spoken about the failures of processes, but the projectization or the modularization of transformation simply doesn't work. Much like, again, anyone who's tried to go on a crash diet, or you buy the latest Wonder Pill and you try and transform your body in January, quickly, quickly, quickly after the holidays. And it's not a one and done thing. Like body transformation, we know you got to show up, you got to do the work, you got to choose what you eat every day, figure out how you move your body every day. It's not something you can do and tick off the box. It's an ongoing process.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe talk to you a bit more about the problems with projectization when it comes to transformation.
Yeah, I mean, again, it goes down to practice and what we do. I think these job losses that we're experiencing, the fact that, for example, graduates are not finding jobs today and are likely to find less jobs going forward, means we fundamentally have to act differently. So what does that look like? What are we investing in sort of, you know, capability and skills-wise, given that in our specific context, and that's just a South African context, or rather African context, there are going to be thousands and thousands of young people. So what are we doing either to facilitate entrepreneurship or to make people employable when it does come to a different kind of role you're going into now? Needing to be an experienced hire means that our graduate programs really fit for purpose. So what is it we're doing to change some of that stuff? If we know AI is coming and technology and quantum computing is the next wave, and that has huge consequences for everybody and everything, then what is it that we're doing to upskill? And it's not like you can now all of a sudden today upskill at scale and be prepared for AI. That's not the answer. That we should have known actually 10 years ago. And that means you have to plan your workforce and your product life cycle in the same way. You actually have to connect those two dots. Like, what are we delivering in the customer space? Who are they going to be in future? How will we be servicing them? And therefore, what are our kind of employees need to look like, and how do we get them there way before we need them to be there? And how do we start to leverage things like vacancies for natural attrition? What do? We just replace. And then all of a sudden there's a project because now we have to cut, when we could have been planning all along through a very simple, quiet, undercover process that we've now reduced our headcount by 1,000 people without it being a huge drama, because actually we have a way through data to be able to detect, plan, and predict what we need to do differently. And so we need to start measuring that, and we don't. We measure other stuff. And this is where I think leaders need to step up.
Anticipation, measurement, repetition, seeing it as a process. Sharon, it sounds like you're talking about the solutionist model, which if you're not familiar with, you should totally buy our book. It's detailed. It's a great 8-step process. We're not going to give too much away today. You really should buy the book. But it is this whole mindset of constantly adjusting, anticipating, noticing what's going on around you, and then adapting your business model to the changing context to continually solve problems together, which was the topic of today's conversation. That ultimately you can't do that unless your whole team is pulling together. And getting people to pull together is a whole lot more than putting up some new wonderful motivational posters with cats on the walls. You actually have to make sure that you've designed the processes and incentives around that to get that machine rolling, to inspire and incentivize people to bring their own agency, their own optimism, and their own enthusiasm to their own tasks, which is a massive challenge, no lies, but hopefully we've given you some things to think about of what to do and not to do, or what not to say, unless you're going to back it up with what you do. And thank you so much for joining us on The Solutionists. We'll be back with more dirty laundry to say the things that you were too scared to say in the boardroom last week. And if you've got any topics that you want us to discuss, or any dirty laundry of your own that you'd like to share anonymously or not anonymously, if you're brave enough, get in touch with us wherever you find us, whichever channel you are listening on. Thanks very much. Thank you for joining us for today's corporate therapy session. If you want The Solutionists to solve a workplace dilemma with you, contact us at survivetheaiapocalypse.com.
Welcome to The Solutionist Movement.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.